just feel it. Yeah, you talk to him. Shout out to the Dadcast Nation. Yo, see, this is the perspective of a dad. Cast it to whomever's interested. Come take this ride with your boy, and I promise to keep it interesting. I'm invested in learning life's lessons so we can grow together. I know the weather be switching up on you, but listen up. It's just life's journeys. This would turn me into a teacher, a father, a husband, a preacher. And I'm trying to reach the top, a writer, an author, an actor, and a director. So when you see the world through my eyes, it's like a reflector of all of that. And I'm all of that, but it's much more to do. See, life is just your movie, and your role is yours to choose. We only get one life to live, and I live my life with prayer. This the Dadcast Podcast, so hit that like and share. Hit that like and share.
Hey, folks, welcome to the Dadcast Podcast. I'm your host, Lavelle Lemonnier, and it is a pleasure to bring to you another exciting episode today. Listen, we've got something great in store for you guys today, and hopefully you'll tune in, get you some popcorn, get something to drink, and listen to this exciting information that we're going to share with you on this episode. Before we get started, I want to say thanks to our sponsors for helping bring this sixth season to life. I also like to thank my lovely wife, Dr. Gabrielle Lemonnier, for helping to inspire this podcast and for being a great help with the content creation. Now, this sixth season of the show has already taken on a life of itself. For the most part, we've been talking about topics that center on the mental health of men, and specifically, we've spent quite a few episodes talking about mental health for African-American men. And today's guest is exceptionally qualified to help us shed some light on this subject. I'm going to go through her bio real quick and get right into this episode. Our guest is a licensed clinical psychologist with years of experience providing psychological services to children, adolescents, and adults. She received her PhD in clinical psychology from Loyola University Chicago and currently serves as the executive director of New Journey Counseling Center. It's a nonprofit organization that's dedicated to providing affordable and culturally competent mental health services to the Houston metropolitan area and to the state of Texas. Now, prior to joining New Journey Counseling Center, she served as director of the Psychological Services Clinic and as a clinical assistant professor for the University of Houston Clear Lake. She has also served as a behavioral health consultant at a large federally qualified health center on the west side of Chicago, serving underrepresented and marginalized patients experiencing many adverse factors, including living in poverty and experiencing community violence. In addition to providing clinical services, our guest is a mental health researcher. Her current interests include researching the utilization of mental health services among minority populations through faith-based organizations. She has published in peer-reviewed journals on topics related to mental health. She also trains, supervises, and mentors master's level and pre-doctoral graduate students, as well as pre-licensed mental health professionals. And in addition to all of that, she finds some time to run a private practice and gives workshops and presentations on various topics related to emotional health and wellness. Dadcast Nation, help me welcome to the show, Dr. Cynthia Campbell Palmer.
Hi, Lavelle. Thank you so much. Thank you for letting me be here. I got a little tired hearing all of that. I didn't realize, my goodness, that's a lot. So, but I love what I do. I really do. I love what I do. So thank you so much for having me.
That's great. Great, great. Thank you for being a guest on the show. And we've got some important things that we want to talk about today on this episode. I've given the audience a little bit about your background, but I'd like to start off with a question that just gives maybe the audience a little more insight into the why behind what you do. So what makes you so passionate about the topic of mental health?
Well, as you know, I'm a licensed clinical psychologist. I've been practicing for about 11 years now. And I have a specialization. I work with children. I have a specialization working with children, adolescents, but my foundation is working with adults. So I work with children, adolescents, and adults. And so in that time, my broad interest has always been around mental health and minority mental health. So since I was a child, I've always loved psychology. I always wanted to help people navigate mental health problems. And I think a lot of us, a lot of mental health professionals will say that. They'll say like, oh, I have a desire to want to help people. And I'm no different. I really did. I wanted to do that. But I think what really navigated and really honed in my passion of wanting to work with minority mental health in that area was my time in Chicago. I had been in Chicago for about 13 years. And when I was there, I worked in hospitals and medical settings that served very low income, even some poverty level, homeless, people who did not have homes or home instability, patients who were from diverse backgrounds and populations. And many of the people who I served, they were experiencing community violence at unprecedented rates, housing shortages, difficulties in school settings, unemployment, underemployment. So I remember just hearing the stories of these patients and their experiences when it came to addressing mental health issues that they had. And many of their problems either went undiagnosed, underdiagnosed, or even overdiagnosed. And I think we'll talk about that a little bit. Others who did have the courage to seek out help, they were met with significant obstacles like lack of affordable services and even a paucity of therapists who were skilled and competent enough to treat them with their with racially or treat people with racially and culturally diverse backgrounds who wanted to implement that into their therapy. So what I saw were that many of the patients, they were being harmed due to racism and discrimination by healthcare, some healthcare professionals who took an oath not to do harm. And in fact, it was the harm was coming from the healthcare professionals' own stereotypical and prejudiced beliefs and views. So that was really harming a lot of people. So over time, I just saw that clients and patients just started really developing a distrust in healthcare professionals. Now, of course, historically, that has happened quite a bit in our people of color who've had a distrust with the healthcare system. But I kept seeing it even in the mental health scheme or topic of healthcare. So it was at that time I decided to do my part to ensure that, you know, when people were coming to get help, that they were receiving appropriate and culturally competent care. And I also wanted people to have a provider that looked like them, and understood, at least on a basic level, the things that they experienced, such as racial discrimination, without them having to explain themselves and their experience over and over again. So, this is why I got into this. This is why I love doing what I do.
It's extremely important, and I'm sure that our audience, many of our audience members, can relate to a lot of the things you've said. If you're in any minority, whether it's African American or Hispanic or females, Black females in particular, there are
Yes.
so many stereotypes that try to attach themselves to these demographics. And so there's some bias, I'm assuming that, and I've read some research recently that says that there's some bias that's or I guess organically it's inherent when you step into a therapist's office. They need to guard themselves against those biases that may be present. I was just reading, and I got some questions for you, but I found some information out today that was so interesting. I think you'll be able to help us understand it a little more. In the American Psychological Association online journal, there's an article that's back from September of 21, and it's titled "Black Men's Mental Health Matters." And in this article, some of this quote really got my attention. It's from Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, in 2014. And he says, being a black man in America means being my brother's keeper. Being a black man in America means being my brother's keeper while keeping a distance from my brother because I don't trust him further than I can see him. It's believing the cops don't care about you. It's learning how not to doubt yourself because when you're born, everyone else already does.
Yeah.
You know, that struck me because every time we step out of the house, to go to work, to go to the grocery store, to go wash the car, to do whatever it is that we do, there's always a chance that someone looks at us and makes a determination before we say or do anything. My wife deals with it all the time. I'm sure you faced it many times. If you're passionate about something, then all of a sudden terms get thrown at you because a woman shouldn't speak like that. And that creates some kind of, you know, mental anguish. And black men, I get it all the time because I'm a big guy. I'm on the elevator and, you know, I see someone clenching their purse and I see people ask me, you know, why don't you smile? I'm like, it's just like I'm just going where I'm going. It's, I don't know. I don't walk around with a smile on my face.
Right.
And all those biases come out. And when it comes to black men, it just seems like we walk out the door behind the eight ball because there's so many things hitting us, facing us. We, you know, angry black men, angry black woman. You know, you're too loud. You're talking too, quote unquote, white. You're talking too black. You're, you know, all these things that contribute to our mental health status. And so, given the backdrop of all of that, this episode, I've titled it, Help, A Man in My Life is Facing a Mental Health Challenge. And the reason I wanted to bring on someone qualified and a female is to try to look at men's mental health from the lens of a female. Because there are a lot of households where men are dealing with stress and anxiety or depression, and they don't know how to deal with it. They don't use the resources that may be available. But that partner, that sister, that mother, that aunt, grandmother, whoever it is in the household with them, has to deal with the outlash sometimes because we lash out in anger if we don't understand our emotions. And so my question then is, what kind of signs do you look for in a man when there's a mental health challenge brewing?
That's a really great question. And by the way, I saw that same quote, and that quote struck me so much to see that by the poet who you mentioned after what happened with Michael Ferguson. So I just want to acknowledge that because that quote is powerful. But when we're talking about signs to look for when there's in a man when there's a mental health challenge, the signs of mental health challenges are often similar, really, for any individual experiencing difficulties, but some to look for, particularly in men. Some of these signs we can start to see what happens with men. So for one, changes in mood. So is the man starting to be a little bit more withdrawn? And so it doesn't necessarily have to be like lying in the bed and not getting out of bed, but maybe not engaging with family and friends like he used to. Not engaging in the activities that he used to enjoy or used to love doing. He's not doing it as much anymore. Some other signs to look for also are they're more irritable. So the man is more irritable. He's maybe losing his temper more often than usual, or he's actually becoming more aggressive or actually becoming aggressive. And this could be verbally or even physically. So these are things that you're not typically seeing in the person, but then all of a sudden you're seeing it now or it's increasing. That's something else to look for to see there could be potentially something going on. Also, struggling with focusing and concentrating, such as at work, so or even if they're in school. So maybe they're becoming more forgetful, things that they are trying to do to keep up with or tasks, they're forgetting to do the task or forgetting to complete things, forgetting steps. And again, this is out of the ordinary for them. Or maybe that they're finding they're having to reread information or redo information just to retain it. So that can also be problematic. And that could also be a sign that something may be going on that's more of a mental health problem. Somatic complaints are the biggest ones, one of the biggest ones to look at. So headaches, any kind of stomach or gut issues, joint pain, muscle tension, anything that's going on that doesn't have a medical cause. So this is something that we see quite a bit with stress, is people are having headaches and these stomach problems and just other kinds of physical symptoms. So that could be a really good sign that maybe there's something else going on with that man, or he's holding his stress in his body, basically. And it often comes out. I always believe in mind, body, soul connection, right? Like everything works together. So if someone's stressed out, it's coming out through your body. It's coming out through what you say, what you think. So this is something to look for. Minimizing or displacing their concerns on others. This is kind of something that we're seeing a lot. So for example, if a woman or someone in their life is saying, oh, I think something's going on. I think you may be struggling in certain areas, and they're minimizing it. No, I'm not struggling. I don't need any help. You're the one that has the problem. Kind of becoming defensive. That could be a sign that there are some mental health challenges that are going on, that maybe they're just either in denial, minimizing, or don't really want to, or don't know how to address or even what to do with it if they're feeling it. Self-medicating is a big one also. So there may be drinking more often. So there's nothing wrong, of course, with socialized drinking, but if the drinking is starting to get in the way of daily functioning, like they're getting drunk, you know, they're engaging in dangerous things, they're engaging in taking dangerous substances or illegal substances, all to self-medicate, to relax, to calm down, to escape. That could be definite signs that there could be something going on. We know that marijuana is legal in some states, but if people are using that and you're seeing an increased use of that, where they're needing it daily just to you know, I've heard people say they need it to eat, they need it to wake up, they need it to go to sleep. Those are things that are not typical and not normal. So that's something else that could be a good sign. Then also if the man is engaging in harmful or dangerous activities, so really risky behavior that's not like them, that could be a sign too that maybe there's something going on. So they're, you know, they may be driving a car, racing and going at high speed levels, or just doing things that are just super harmful to them. And that's out of the ordinary for them. And then also finally, suicidal and homicidal ideation. So if they are thinking about having recurrent thoughts about death, hurting themselves or hurting others, if they're making serious threats to do harm to themselves or others, if they're researching topics online about death or dying, those are all significant signs that this person, this man, is experiencing some challenges and he may need some help. So this is not an exhaustive list, but this is definitely some signs that you can look for.
Right. And given that information, I know a lot of times, you know, the big mama in the house or something, big mama in the family, has a way of toughening up men. Mm-hmm. You know, get it together, pull yourself together, stop crying. You know, you need to go out there and make it happen. And, you know, whatever the phrase might be that basically tells a man to just get over it and you know, handle it. Where is the line between being an enabler and being condescending?
That's a really good question. I think the line, what I would think is the line, it's well, first of all, starting with being condescending, it has to come from a good place and a good heart, you know? So a lot of times, you know, Big Mama was telling us that because that's how we had to get through as people, right? We didn't have a choice. We got to pull ourselves up. So we got to do what we have to do. It wasn't always the best thing, but it was the only way we could manage. So if it's coming from a place where they're really just trying to help, they just don't know what to say and they're not saying the right things, then that's where we, when we're helping individuals who are having, or men who are having difficulties or stress, we can alter how we help them. So it's more of being supportive. It's more of, and I'm going to talk more about this, but it's more of being supportive and more of letting them know, I'm here for you if you need me. What can we do to keep moving forward? But enabling is just allowing the behavior to become destructive for the person. So this is the opposite, where it's like, oh, don't worry about Junior, he just that way, and just leave him alone. Well, no, because it's destructive. The behavior he's doing is harming him. So that's where the enabling comes in, when it's not helpful. If it's not helping the person by, you know, allowing them to stay in that, allowing them to just struggle and suffer, and then nobody does anything or says anything, just let them be, that's not good either too. So we have to find the balance of how we can help without being overbearing and without, you know, putting things, making them feel like they're lower, you know, making them feel like they're struggling and they have problems because they can't get it together. But finding that balance of, I know this is a struggle, what can I do to help? Because you can't stay here, but I want to help you in whatever way that I can. Did that answer right. the question?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I'm hearing you say, understand the difference between constructive and destructive.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you know, we've looked at some questions that we're going to talk about, but these things are popping in my mind, and I want to discuss them, because I think that a lot of men just hide what they're feeling. So they mask it, in order to show a strong face for the family, or to be the, you know, be seen as a provider or the protector. But a lot of times, based on trauma that we've had in our lives, we it's different. Every man is different. No, there's no, you know, one, I don't think there's one cookie cutter way that men deal with anxiety or depression or stress. It really kind of depends on the context of what has made you who you are at that moment. And so, you know, I'm assuming that there are a lot of men who would watch an episode like this or listen to it on the audio version, and just, they know that something we're saying is relevant to them, but they are not ready to deal with it, or they hear it, but they're just not, they're not moving on anything to make it better. Mm-hmm. How do you, as a clinician, a psychologist, how do you, if that man comes in your office and, you know, and says, I'm here because the court made me come. I had mm-hmm. to do it as a part of a court order, but nothing's wrong with me. Mm-hmm. How do you break that wall down? And how does a layperson try to break that wall down?
That's a really great question. It's not easy, but what I would start with, so using the example that you said about maybe someone, a man was court ordered to come to therapy, and they're coming in, I don't know why I'm here, I don't want to be here, I don't need to be here. How I would approach it is, I would say, well, you know, I would acknowledge the frustration of being there. I would ask them why they think they've been brought here, why they think it's been mandated, just to get an idea of what their understanding of what happened or what brought them to this point and why they're in therapy. And then from that point, I just talk to them about, well, we have this time. So rather than me telling you what we should be working on, I want to invite you to let me know if there are some things that you've ever wanted to improve on or things that you ever wanted to work on. How do you want to use your time? And I invite them to make the decision, because this is about them. This is their therapy session. So it's not about focusing on, you have anger management problems, so we're going to specifically work on that and then check off the boxes and we're done. I can't get anywhere with that. You know what I mean? I could, and they can go through the motions, But if they're in therapy, I want them to make the most of it. So I invite them to tell me if there's anything they ever wanted to work on or talk about. What would you like to discuss? Why don't we discuss your frustration for even being here? Because you don't feel you need to be here. I start where they are. I start wherever they're giving to me is where we start. Because it's not easy. It's not easy coming to therapy. It's not easy having to face difficulties. So I always start with where they want to start. I'm very much a client-centered person, if that makes sense.
So this statistic I'm looking at says that 26.4% of Black and Hispanic men ages 18 to 44 who experience daily feelings of anxiety or depression were likely to have used mental health services compared to 45.4% of non-Hispanic white men. Yeah. So the data shows us that Black and brown men just don't use it at a high rate, the resources that are available to them.
Absolutely.
And that kind of segues into the next question I want to ask you. Is there data to suggest that men and women deal differently with mental health issues?
Mm-hmm. Yes, there is some research that suggests that men handle mental health issues differently. So one study that I did find from the American Psychological Association is they found that Black women and girls, they engaged in more healthy lifestyle activities, such as exercising and nutritional eating, more than Black men and boys when they were experiencing discrimination. As we know, discrimination can be a significant contributor to emotional health difficulties in African-American people. And there was another statistic that I found too, that according to the CDC, men are more likely to die from suicide than women are. So there are several factors that may contribute to how Black men and women manage their emotional difficulties. But and you were hinting at this before, one of the major tenets is the ideology around masculinity. And so there are these harmful and false messages that we receive or that society gives out or that we even hear in our families sometimes, such as men are always supposed to be strong, never supposed to show any kind of vulnerability. A man is weak if he needs help or if he can't handle his own problems. Even if he's seeking mental health services, he must be crazy. All these kinds of messages that we hear often lead to dangerous and potentially harmful outcomes in men. So this leads to one of the reasons why men do manage their mental health differently, because they live under these kinds of stereotypes. So some research have even found that Black men ascribe to this masculinity notion at higher rates than non-Black counterparts. And so this may be due to the fact that they are experiencing racially based areas or areas in their lives that they face, that other Black men face, that other people don't have to face. There's this research that was done by Dr. Majors and Dr. Mancini Bilson, and it talked about Black men who were coming from lower socioeconomic backgrounds or even living in poverty. And they saw that sometimes these men had to present this kind of aloof swagger demeanor. And what it was it almost like an I don't care kind of demeanor. And it was to protect themselves against the life circumstances and racism and discrimination that they just face on a daily basis. So this can erode at their physical and mental health. So it's this also can add to why men are handling things differently, because they have to show this presence of like, you know, it doesn't bother me. I'm good. When really they're not good. So there's also research that shows that if men view their attempts to meet these expectations of masculinity, if they view their attempts as not successful or that they're not living up to this notion, and this could be for many different reasons, even some oppressive systemic reasons why they're not feeling like they're living up to this notion, it can cause significant strain and stress. Even think about this also for the LGBTQ plus community as well. So like Black men in this population, it's also significantly detrimental to their mental health, because again, they're definitely not living up to that masculinity notion, and that causes just significant difficulties and problems, and it gets in the way of them seeking help. So I think these are some of the reasons, could be some of the reasons why men and women do cope differently when it comes to mental health.
There's a another psychologist in the Houston area that I see in this article, Jessica Jackson, who says, she says, when Black men start to gain a more extensive emotional vocabulary, it provides fuel for the next stages of therapeutic work, addressing past traumas and learning how to communicate more effectively in relationships. Do you find that to be true? That emotional intelligence, when we're talking about mental health, emotional intelligence plays some role in it, I'm assuming. I haven't looked at the data on that, but I'm assuming that different people at different stages of emotional intelligence have a different experience when they're facing pressures. Something?
Yeah, I agree. Because if you think about, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No. I think we're having a little lag, but go ahead.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a, yeah. Okay, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. So you were talking about how emotional intelligence can impact how people manage their mental health. Is that what you were saying?
Yes.
Okay. I do agree. And I think that I agree that definitely emotional intelligence can help. I think what she's probably referring to is, if you think about it, because men are not encouraged to express themselves, they're not encouraged to talk about their emotions and their feelings, they may not have the language to be able to describe it. They may not have the words to describe what they're feeling, because they were never encouraged to even develop that in the first place. So by helping men to be able to develop that kind of language, that emotional, that affect identification, that emotional intelligence, I think it does lend to being able to have better emotional expression, which then can lead to better relationships and better ways that they can interact with others. So I do agree with what she's saying, because it's not something that many men are encouraged to do at all. So yeah, when they can get that emotional intelligence, I think that can really be significant in their therapeutic journey.
I'm going to ask you a pretty pointed question.
Okay.
Can a white psychologist help a Black male client?
That is a very pointed question. Honestly, it depends on the psychologist. If that white psychologist is culturally competent, and
what do you mean by culturally competent? Because I understand, but maybe some of our audience doesn't quite understand that term.
Okay, so what I mean is that they have an awareness of how culture and different various diverse backgrounds can impact a person, can impact their life, how they live, what they believe, how they rear their children, how they live their lives, and how it impacts them physically and mentally. And so having that appreciation and understanding, but not just the appreciation and understanding, but actually seeking out the information and knowledge, how different things manifest in this certain culture or this person's background and how it impacts their life today. And not only that, a part of cultural competence is also understanding your own bias, Your own prejudice, your own stereotypical thinking. So it's acknowledging the fact that you come in with biases, prejudices that could impact the therapeutic space. So having all of those together allows you to be able to have a space where you can talk to that person from a diverse background and be able to help them with what's going on. The worst thing that I think that can happen, one of the things, is just a downplaying. And I've heard this happen many times before, where some white therapist will, if a Black person is coming in and talking about the microaggressions that they experience at work. So meaning those undercover racist comments and actions and behaviors that can wear on you on a daily basis. If they're coming in and complaining, man, I think they're being racist towards me. That if that white therapist is talking about, well, what are you doing to, you know, to contribute to the problems and things like that, they're not understanding. That's not competence. But understanding the fact that racial discrimination can affect someone's mental health, that's part of cultural competence. That's an example. So I do believe that white therapists can help African-American men, but they have to be able to have that competence. They have to be able to understand and not be afraid to address those issues with that person, with that man. And I'll even throw it in there, just because you're a Black person or a person of color doesn't mean you can work with other individuals too. That we have to have cultural competence as well. I have clients from the whole diaspora, you know, so I have clients from different Caribbean areas, Haitian and African and different cultures in Africa. So it, just because I'm Black doesn't mean I'm culturally competent. I have to do my work as well, too.
That makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. I travel a lot, and I meet a lot of people from different continents. And it's so evident in just the way we speak to each other many times. You know, I've said it in some comedic spaces before, but, you know, a white guy will say, how are you? And drop their head. And a Black guy will say, what's up? You know, yeah. And throw their head up. And just those subtle differences, mm-hmm. Can sometimes, you know, drive a wedge between people and cause some mental stress. I was actually in a restaurant some months back, and this lady, we were waiting on our food, and this lady comes up to me and she says, does anybody ever tell you who you look like? And I was like, you know, I don't even want this conversation, but I'm like, no. And she said, you look like that televangelist T.D. Jakes. And I'm like, what? I don't look anything like T.D. Jakes. Like, we both have a bald head and a beard. That's about it. And then so I thought about it. She was an older white lady. Mm. And after a few minutes, I said, ma'am, do you mind if I say something to you? I don't mean it to be offensive in any way, but I just want to give you some information. She was like, yeah, sure. I said, as a Black man, and most of us do feel this way, as soon as you say, I look like someone, before you even say who it is, it already offends me.
Absolutely.
Because you're drawing a comparison, either because you don't have anything to say, you don't know how to speak to me, or you just think we all look alike. And it's offensive. And she said, oh, I never thought about that. No one has ever said that to me. Thank you for telling me that. The point that I'm making is that all of those things, when you talk about microaggressions and you talk about stereotypes and biases, those little conversations like that, that people, and interactions that people can have on a day-to-day basis, can contribute to a feeling of being overwhelmed. So you get home that evening and you've dealt with all these things at work. You faced all these pressures and deadlines, and then you face microaggressions and you face stereotypes. And then you come home and a bill is due that didn't get paid.
Right.
Now is another pressure.
Right.
You're expected to make sure that, you know, things work out well.
Right.
And those things, I've just seen in a lot of the Black men that I sit and talk to, That pressure weighs on you, and it weighs on you, and it weighs on you. And if you don't have an outlet to discuss it, to talk about how it makes you feel, to stress relief, it really builds, some mental anguish on a lot of men. And I know, and some people watching this will say, well, it's not just men, it's women, and it is women as well, because we could have a whole other episode on the issues that women deal with when it comes to mental health that, is suppressed many times because they're helping out or they're leading, a family or something like that. So I do understand that there are these pressures on both sides, but for the sake of this episode, we're trying to focus on men. I wanted to ask you another question. Is there data to suggest that African American males go, and I think you mentioned or alluded to this earlier, often go misdiagnosed or underdiagnosed, and you mentioned even overdiagnosed when it comes to mental health?
Absolutely, yes. And unfortunately, and you actually alluded to this also, unfortunately, this is a reality for both African American men and women. One research study found that, and I've seen this personally in my work, but found that Black people were more likely to be misdiagnosed with schizophrenia than their non-white or than their white counterparts. So this is so critical because we know schizophrenia is a very serious mental illness. And left untreated or mistreated, it can cause severe outcomes for individuals. So these individuals who were being misdiagnosed with schizophrenia, some of them were actually experiencing depression with psychotic features, which means that psychotic features, meaning they may be hearing or seeing things that aren't there. They're so depressed. That's what sometimes happens to individuals who are really depressed. And then some of them may have even been experiencing bipolar disorder. So when a person's in a manic state, which is a part of bipolar disorder, and that means that their behavior is really extreme, they're engaging in dangerous activities, they may feel untouchable, they have these unusual amounts of energy, all that's a manic state. But that also, those are some symptoms that also look like schizophrenia also. Being misdiagnosed can significantly impact the healing because the treatment is inaccurate and it's not appropriate to address the symptoms. And this misdiagnosis often occurs due to some healthcare professionals basing their assessments of African American men on stereotypes, what we've been talking about, and racist ideology. So, for example, if a Black man comes into the emergency room and they're acting paranoid or they're aggressive, they're automatically being diagnosed with schizophrenia, and or they've been labeled they're on drugs, and then they're just given medication quickly or sedated, and then that's it. They're receiving this quick assessment that's not thorough. But that same Black man who's coming in, they may actually be experiencing a medical crisis. So maybe they're having some sort of like focal seizures, or they're diabetic and their blood sugar is low. And that can cause a lot of mental, we call it mental, mini mental status, but that can cause their mini mental status, like their cognition, how they're speaking, how they're talking, that can cause all of that to be delayed or disrupted. They could even be having an allergic reaction to maybe a newly prescribed medication. They may even have had a traumatic brain injury or some type of other medical emergency. So what's happening is these people are getting overdiagnosed without having a thorough assessment. I have to tell these two stories because these are always so impactful for me. But in my clinical experience, I found that many of the African American patients that I was working with, many of them have been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And but they didn't really receive an in-depth appropriate assessment. They came in crisis, and because of their behavior, they were just automatically diagnosed with bipolar. When what really happened was after I did my own assessment, some of them actually were experiencing PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. So, and then they were wondering why they weren't getting better on the medications and the treatments. And once we flipped it and started to treat them for the PTSD, then they started getting relief from their symptoms. And so it's so detrimental that this happens. And this happens for our young boys as well too, our African-American boys in school and pediatric settings. So in school settings, if a little Black boy is acting out or having behavioral problems, what's the first thing that they do? They're labeling them as oppositional, problem children, defiant, when really these little boys may be experiencing depression, learning difficulties, anxiety, abuse, or even trauma. So no one's doing full assessments. They're just looking at these Black men, looking at these Black boys and just saying, oh, you know, they must be on drugs. They must be just being defiant, oppositional, and not really going in deep and doing an appropriate assessment to figure out what's really going on, which lends to this whole cycle of why men aren't talking about what's happening and what's going on with them and not getting the appropriate treatment.
Yeah, and that also, I know we're not talking about adolescents or youth specifically in this episode, but from a parental standpoint, even within the Black community, many times I find that we as parents misdiagnose, for lack of a better term, the behavior of our children, labeling them as just bad, or they're, you know, he's just, you know, he's hyper or whatever
he's
the case
being
might
manipulative.
Be.
Yeah. I've heard that so many times, a five-year-old being manipulative, but that's what's said. So, yeah.
So we, you know, I think we have to get more information, have more knowledge so that we understand a better way to raise children, because we're seeing it as these generations are coming up. We definitely see the way they deal with life is different than the way my generation dealt with it and the generation before me dealt with it, because they have so much access to information and so many gadgets and technology at their fingertips. Yep. You know, it's a different world.
Absolutely.
when it comes to raising children. And that can contribute to mental health challenges for a man as well.
Yeah.
Because the way I was raised by parents who were born in the 20s and who were not far removed from slavery,
yes.
They had a very stern way. My dad, you know, it was today he would be in jail for it, but he hit me across the chest with a 2x4 one time, because, you know, I was messing with the lawnmower and left some skid marks on the driveway. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that was his way of making sure that I did what I was supposed to do and didn't tear up the things that he worked hard to accumulate.
Right.
When I had my own children, you know, I thought that being a stern disciplinarian was my job, because that was how I wasn't. I mean, that was a case of abuse, but it wasn't like I was being abused every day. I still had a, you know, fairly loving home.
Mm-hmm.
But with my children, and I thought it was my responsibility to be the disciplinarian.
Mm-hmm.
Only to find out as they got older and became adults that some of those ways, that the things that I did, it just wasn't the best way to parent them, because
mm-hmm.
every child is different. Anyway, we could get on a whole, you know,
oh, yeah.
a whole different string of topics on this issue.
Yeah.
There are a few more questions I do want to ask you just for the sake of time.
Sure.
What are some resources for men who need assistance? Where can, so, you know, of course, many Black men are saying, I'm not going to see a shrink. Like, I'm good. Nothing's wrong with me. But sometimes we need to. I mean, I've seen a therapist for PTSD issues, for anger management issues, those kinds of things. And it helped me tremendously, because the barbershop doesn't always have the answer for us.
Uh-uh.
That's been our therapy ground for so many years, but it's not always the best therapy.
Absolutely.
So what are some resources for men who need assistance?
Well, what I would recommend is, of course, I definitely recommend the therapy route as well too. So I would start with your employee assistance program for men who are in places of employment that have this. It's basically your EAP. So it's your employee assistance program, and many of them offer several sessions for free for you to be able to talk to a counselor. And this source is free to you. It's a part of you being an employer. I mean, I'm sorry, an employee. And your employer will never know that you have utilized the EAP because it's all supposed to be confidential. So this is something that's a resource that a lot of people don't recognize that they have, but their EAP, their employee assistance program, you can contact it through your HR department. You can get a number of unlimited sessions with a counselor to be able to talk about things, and you can keep your confidentiality. Your employer will never know. There's also ways that you can seek through therapy services through your insurance. So even many medical insurance plans, even the marketplace plans, they all have some sort of mental health benefit. So that's just a matter of you calling. And even on the insurance cards, on the back of the cards, they have a number, many of them dedicated to behavioral health. That's another name for mental health, where you can call and get targeted services. They can provide you with a list of providers that are under your insurance. And then you can look those providers up to find out if this is somebody who's going to be, you can work with, find out who they are. A lot of mental health providers have descriptions about what they do. You can see their pictures. So that's a really great way to also be able to access services. So if you don't have if you don't have insurance, there's like, for example, in Texas, there's a lot of people who do not have insurance or can't afford their co-pays through insurance. So if that's the case, you can also access therapy sessions through federally qualified health centers. So these are large centers that receive federal funding, and they provide medical and mental health services at a very low cost, or sometimes even free, based on your income or based on qualifications. So that's also a good place to be able to seek out mental health or behavioral health services. You can find these by contacting your local like 211 or 311 number to get the names of those facilities, or even going through your United Way chapter. Those are ways to be able to find out these nonprofits or these facilities that provide services or free services and counseling. Some churches even offer counseling. This is starting a movement that's starting to get more and more, where churches are taking on the mantle of like mental health services. So you can even do that and get services through a church. However, you must make sure that that counselor is licensed and a professional, not just not Sister Anne who decides that she wants to be able to talk to you about things. No, it needs to be a licensed person. And many churches are starting to understand that they are hiring people, are using their church members who are licensed in order to provide services. So those are, and just on top of that, even though thinking of the resources, I want to be able to just say this really quick. When you are looking for a therapist, interview your therapist like you would a job. So you have a right to ask questions. If they don't offer a free consultation, ask them for a brief consultation for you to be able to ask questions about how they work with African American men. How do they incorporate cultural factors into treatment? I can give a whole talk on how to find a good therapist, but that's something else that you can do too. You can ask questions of that therapist, and that can help you to determine if they're going to be a good fit for you. So,
Okay, great. Those are some good resources. And to our audience, you can see that information on your screen, and it'll also be available at the end of this podcast episode on a separate slide, a separate screen. You kind of touched on the next question I had, but I guess I'll go in a little different direction. I do want to ask the question though, because it's a good question. Do you think that faith plays a role in mental health, or is this purely a matter of science and medicine? And the reason I'm asking that is because the Lord's gonna fix it. He's
Come
always
on.
on time and
Come on.
all these things that we say.
Well.
God's got you. Don't worry about it. But the truth is that just saying that doesn't necessarily change a person's situation. Church people are very good at saying, I'm gonna pray for you. I find in my long experience with the church that they're the ones who say it and the ones who do it, there's a gap most of the time. And
Absolutely.
even just, I'm a proponent of prayer and meditation, affirmations. I make daily affirmations every single day. And those things, they do wonders in my life. But a lot of times, it's not enough to just go to church, hear a good sermon, hear a song that moves you, and then walk out and you're still facing the same circumstances that you were facing when you went in. They're not gonna magically disappear. So, how does faith play a role, regardless of what? I'm a proponent of a faith, but for the purposes of this podcast, how does just faith in general, does it play a role in mental health, or is this just science and medicine?
That is a great question. It really is. And it's one I get often, especially with the work that I did in Chicago, because one of the places I worked was at a it was a federally qualified health center and it was a Christian center. So we got this question quite a bit. I think faith plays a significant role in mental health, both in a positive and a negative way. So for many, prayer, meditation, and other spiritual practices and rituals can greatly have a positive impact on mental health difficulties. There is strong research and evidence that shows that faith and spiritual engagement can be effective in managing and coping with mental health difficulties like trauma or depression or anxiety. Even historically, African Americans have turned, to faith-based practices to help them with managing stress and emotional difficulties. But for some, religion can exacerbate mental health problems. So, for some people, they may use religion to confirm negative thoughts or feelings about themselves, such as believing that God is punishing them because they're going through trials and tribulations, or that God will never forgive them, or that something must be wrong with me. I must be flawed. God must just be mad at me. So those kinds of things is where when you're using religion in that way, it's actually can be harmful. And then, as you were alluding to, like others can help to also cause harm using religion. So, people often misinterpret scriptures and religious doctrine to assign shame and guilt upon others, which can have a negative impact on a person's emotional well-being. So, for example, some are told that, oh, if you're struggling with difficulties because you lack faith in God, God is punishing you for doing whatever, or you're not praying or believing enough. So in those respects, that's not helpful at all. So I do think faith has a very significant role in how we manage our mental health. I think we have to use it appropriately. We have to use it and just, I believe in faith as well. So we have to use it in the way that it was supposed to be used, which is it's supposed to be encouraging. It's supposed to uplift you. It's not supposed to drag you down and make you feel worse. Because then it's counterproductive. So yes, I am a strong proponent of faith. Research proves that it helps, but it has to be in a way that is not making people feel worse or they're using it as a weapon.
Do you not trust God if I go see a therapist?
The Bible says, seek wise and godly counsel. So, I mean, that's the word. But no, I mean, I think God, this is what we used to say to people when I worked at that federally qualified center in Chicago, and people would come in and say, well, I mean, if I'm believing in God, then I don't need therapy. And I always used to tell them, God can use anything to heal, anything he chooses. You think of God can use people. He can speak a word. He can, you know, anything. He can, anything he could decides to use, he can use it. He gives us the unction to create medications to help us. You know, he gives us the unction to create therapies and treatments. So I believe it's all God inspired. So God can use people to heal. He can do whatever he chooses. So I say, don't put God in a box that he only heals you in this way. He could use whatever he wants, including therapy, to bring about healing.
Okay. I want to stay there, but I'm, for the lack of time, I'm not going to.
Yeah.
But
that's another to our podcast.
It is. And to our Dadcast Nation, you know, if you are in a position where you're needing assistance, and you can start with areas that are familiar to you, your church, your synagogue, your mosque, your 12-step group, whatever the case might be. Those are areas that are familiar to you, and perhaps you can reach out and get assistance through those avenues. But if those areas don't work or they're not comfortable for you, reach out to some of the resources that we've discussed today. Look online. I went to BetterHelp, and it worked for me just by, you know, Googling something for services and finding the right kind of therapist. And it helped just to be able to talk it out with someone who's qualified to have that discussion with you. So I'm not going to belabor it anymore. I ask you now how our audience can get in touch with you. If they have questions or they're interested in perhaps securing your services, how can they reach out to you?
Well, there are two ways they can reach out. They can go to either one of our websites. I have one, drcampbellpalmer.com is my personal website. And then our nonprofit's website, newjourneycenter.org. You can go there, find out more about us. We have our contact page there. Our social media links are there as well, too, to be able to reach out to us.
Okay. Very well. Thank you for engaging me in this discussion. I wish we had a lot more time. Perhaps we may even have to come back and do it again. I'm thinking of having maybe a panel discussion with some folks like yourself who are qualified to have this discussion, just because I think that we've got to keep shining a light on the awareness that goes along with recovering. When it comes to mental health issues. So thank you again so much for all the information you've given us. To our Dadcast Nation, I want to thank you for tuning in today. Please remember to like, love, share this episode, especially this episode. Make sure you share it. Let other people watch it or listen to it. So you can subscribe to our YouTube channel, to our Instagram channel. You can find us on Facebook, on X, and even on TikTok. If you'd like to email us and send your comments or questions to dadcastcomments@gmail.com. And again, make sure you reach out to Dr. Campbell Palmer if you'd like to ask her some questions or ask her questions about the services that she provides. Again, thank you so much for spending time with us today. And we look forward. I'm going to give you just a couple seconds if you'd like to have some closing remarks to our audience.
Oh, I just want to say thank you so much for allowing me to be a part of this very, very important topic. I really appreciate it. And I just commend you for the work that you're doing. This is such an important topic. So any man out there who's experiencing difficulties, you're still a man. You know, you are still a man, whether you seek help. It's not a judgment on your character. Get help for you, for your family. Get help so that you can be at your best and operate at your best.
All right, folks. Well, you heard it well from Dr. Campbell Palmer and from the Dadcast podcast. Next time, we'll come back and have some more good information for you. But until then, as I always like to say, peace and blessings, and I'm out.
Just feel it. Yeah, you talk to him. Shout out to the Dadcast Nation. Yo, see, this is the perspective of a dad. Cast it to whomever's interested. Come take this ride with your boy, and I promise to keep it interesting. I'm invested in learning life's lessons so we can grow together. I know the weather be switching up on you, but listen up. It's just life's journeys. This would turn me into a teacher, a father, a husband, a preacher. And I'm trying to reach the top, a writer, an author, an actor, and a director. So when you see the world through my eyes, it's like a reflection of all of that. And I'm all of that, but it's much more to do. See, life is just your movie, and your role is yours to choose. We only get one life to live, and I live my life with prayer. This the Dadcast Podcast, so hit that like and share. 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 Yeah, hit that like and share.